Welcome to my journeys and stories around the old county of Gwent. And here in the middle of July, on the south coast of Gwent, it's seaside time and seaside weather. And I think Rambler must be in holiday spirits. I've caught sight of her a few times, sitting on a rock just below the sea wall, looking out across the Seven Sea. And she sits there still and joyfully content, as far as I can see. At one point, I saw her sat combing her hair, and it was glistening brightly in the sun. I had to stop myself from checking whether or not she had somehow acquired a fish's tail. But no, she just had the usual pair of legs, and the sun was glinting on a few silver-grey streaks in the dark hair that she was piling up on top of her head to keep cool. But the sunlight and the sea can make strange reflections. In fact, the place where the Rambler was sat was not far from Goldcliff, where a priory once stood, and Goldcliff was named from a trick of the light, because there was a bed of yellow mica in the rock of the cliff. And Gerald of Wales tells us that the cliffs, when viewed from the sea, shone wondrous gold. The place where Goldcliff Priory used to stand is now occupied by Hill Farm, though you'd be forgiven for wondering where the hill is. At most, it appears as a slight raise in the ground, in the flat lands that stretch all along this Gwent coast. The extent of the levels is bounded by the River Wye away to the east and the Rumney River over to the west. And in the middle, dividing the levels quite neatly into two, with the Caldecott levels on the one hand and the Wentloog levels on the other, is the River Usk. And the Usk and the Rumney and the Wye all enter the Seven Sea on this southern coast. The Usk has flowed for about 78 miles to reach the sea here, from its source on the Black Mountain in the west of the Brecon Beacons, and it's run its whole journey within Wales. And we're going to stop here for a while, at this halfway point that the Usk conveniently marks for us. This river has a special place in my heart, and I was born just a couple of fields away from one of the main tributaries of the Usk, the Avon Llwyd. Avon Llwyd was originally called Torfaen, Stonebreaker, and as you might imagine, the Usk has a good few tributaries, all with wonderful names. Avon Kilieni, Nant Bran, Avon Ysgyr, Avon Honddu, Rhiangoll, Grwyni Fawr, Gafenni, Olwey Brook, Afon Hydfer, Afon Crai, Afon Seni, Afon Tarell, Afon Cynrig, Nant Menasgyn, Caerfannell, Afon Crawnon, Clydach, Berthyn Brook, Sôr Brook, Afon Llwyd, Ebw. All of them flowing into the Usk, through meadows and moors and towns and villages, all the way here to Uskmouth, weaving in their own particular stories as they go. Now, when the waters of the Usk reach the Seven Sea, they meet miracles of mud. Mud and silt, that's a feature of the coastline on the Gwent Levels. And at Uskmouth, and at Goldcliff, and Magop Hill, and Redwick, the land and water have kept some special traces in the silty clay. Particular footprints, the tracks of a child walking beside an adult over the land, here in Mesolithic times, over 7,000 years ago, back to 12 or 13,000 years ago, a time when the frozen ice waters had melted and left a network of rich marshlands and shallow waters and islands, summer visiting grounds for people who moved as they lived and lived as they moved before the first days of settled farming. Here are the footprints of our ancestors who came and went from near and far. Their footprints are exposed now at the lowest of tides, though you need to be guided to find them by somebody who knows how to pick their way through the treacherous mud and how to see what we can easily miss. And there are the marks of birds' feet too. The footprints of cranes. From a summer's day nearly 8,000 years ago, they say, when the birds came here as a safe breeding ground, a place for their chicks to fledge. These footprints, these marks in the mud, have become quite famous now. You can see casts of them in Newport Museum. And there are the remains of a Mesolithic oak forest too near the mouth of the Esk, and the bones of the animals who moved under the trees long ago. I think about the marks of the crane's feet in the mud, watching that their young get the best start. I think about the child's footprint walking alongside an adult. I think about a vivid memory I have of looking down at my own 5-year-old feet in the muddy, sandy shoreline as I paddled further upstream on the banks of the Esk. It's a huge line of ancestry that the traces found by the river cast out to us, a glimpse into our own history, a long line of belonging, of connecting. And you know, it's a lovely thing too, that it just so happens that our word pedigree comes from the French for crane's foot, pied de grue. The long wide toes of the crane's feet spreading out are like an ancestral chart showing us where we've come from. Our belonging, our connection is wide and long. And our pedigrees are infinitely inclusive. Yes, we can see all that at the mouth of the Esk and these few muddy miles of the coast here. So yes, rivers can be good at keeping things. And so can mud. And the Esk River mud has kept many secrets and memories safe. And there is one secret that the Esk mud was keeping that came to light 23 years ago in Newport. It was a sailing ship that 600 years or so ago had been busy carrying goods back and forth across the sea, along the Iberian coast, to Britain, and had come up the Esk on a high tide to Newport for some repairs. And the ship was carefully propped up in a little cutting alongside the river so that she could be worked on. And there she stayed, and the muddy waters closed over her and the land covered her until the time when the Riverfront Art Centre was being built. And the workers had to dig extra deep foundations for the orchestra pit. And in doing so, they began to uncover the timbers of a ship. Now, since its discovery, the Newport Medieval Ship, because no other name has been discovered for it yet, is being restored bit by bit, and many of its secrets are being slowly researched and uncovered. Now, my imagination has always been fired by ships and voyages, and I've been following the story of the Newport ship for some years now, and woven into the edges of it myself now and then too. So I went down to the warehouse on the industrial estate on the edges of Newport, where the ship is temporarily housed, and which is open to the public a couple of days a week and is full of fascinating information. And I had a chat to the wonderful curator, Toby Jones, to get a kind of an overview of what had happened so far to the ship and what the hopes were for the future. And it was the hottest day of the year, so we sat in the wonderfully cool insulated wood store that doubles as a research library. But you may hear a few noises off from beyond the door as volunteers show visitors around the exhibition.
My name is Toby Jones. I'm the curator of the Medieval Ship Project. The ship is part of the Newport Museum and Art Gallery. The ship was discovered in the summer of 2002, and it took about 6 months to excavate and recover the ship. And then in order to save the ship, they actually had to take it apart into thousands of individual timbers. And so those were recovered along with around 1,000 artifacts. And the entire assemblage was eventually brought together into one huge warehouse. Everything was kept in tanks of water. And in 2004, we started a pilot study figuring out how do you clean all this huge amount of material, how do you record it, and these are both steps you need to do before you conserve it. And here we are 23 years later. The medieval ship is now fully conserved. All the timbers are dry, strong, and stable. The artifacts are all dried out, but it's still in some 2,500 pieces. And the idea now is that we're going to take all of our pieces and reassemble the ship. So we need a very large space to do this, and even the current warehouse we're in, as big as it is, isn't big enough for this next phase. So right now the city is working on plans to find and secure a site for us to do a trial reassembly of the Newport ship. As soon as we have a site, we're going to take all the individual timbers put the ship back together piece by piece. That'll probably take us 3 or 4 years to actually put it all back together. The public can watch and participate and help us build the thing. So that's the plan at the moment.
That is a brilliant synopsis of 23 plus years of really hard work.
Yeah, it's. But we spent years and years just cleaning the timbers and just very carefully drawing all the timbers. And so we had many, many people involved in the project. And I remember doing the numbers in 2012, so that was about 8 years in. We had done 110,000 hours of work in the warehouse. It's an incredible amount of human effort has gone into the project to this point, but it's going to be amazing when it's reassembled.
I mean, it's amazing already looking at all you've uncovered and so far. Are all the pieces here in this warehouse?
Yeah, so we're sitting in one of the big timber stores right now, and there's around 1,500 timbers. And the one next to us, same size, there's 1,000 timbers in there, and plus all the artifacts. We actually know the timbers that we've tested using dendrochronology, tree ring dating, they all gave the exact same date. They were all cut down. The trees were cut down between September of 1457 and March of 1458. So it gives us a absolutely fixed point when they're starting to build the ship. And we also know where, because the timbers are from the Basque country in northern Spain. And then we have also great dates for when the ship came into Newport. Again, tree ring dates of timbers found above and below the ship during the excavation. These are from sometime between the spring of 1468 and the winter of 1469. So in really simple terms, the ship had about a 10-year life. It's Basque in origin. However, every single thing we found on board is Portuguese. Every ceramic, every coin, all the and bits of environmental evidence, certain nuts and seeds that have very specific geographical origins, all of that is from Portugal, really central Portugal, south towards the Algarve. It looks like it was Portuguese crewed and owned, and we know what it was engaged in. We found over 100 parts and pieces of casks, big oak casks, that would have been used to carry red wine. And so it looks like the ship was engaged in the wine trade, and that aligns perfectly with the customs records that we have of the time from Bristol, the big port nearby. 90% of everything coming into Bristol in the 1450s and 60s was wine, and it would have been coming in on ships exactly like this one, well, including this one.
So is it a Welsh ship by accident then? Just by accident of sailing up the Usk and not sailing out again?
It really doesn't have any British links to it apart from the fact that it's obviously it's trading with this area. We don't even think the ship is necessarily overwintering here. These big ships potentially only did one major voyage a year, and that's as soon as the grapes are harvested, the wine is made very quickly, and it's put into casks and raced up here. And I think the ship unloaded the wine, turned around and went back, because if they'd been overwintering here, we would expect to find some British things, like British ceramics or certain foodstuffs from this area, coins. We find absolutely nothing, and it's all Iberian in origin. So the ship is almost a transient visitor. You know, just the cargo had to go to Bristol. Bristol was the customs port. Newport was a town of maybe 1,000 people at this point. You weren't allowed to bring big ships like that here for trade purposes. What we think happened was it went to Bristol, traded its cargo of wine, and then Newport's only across the Severn Estuary, pops over to Newport for repairs. And we can see that the ship is actively being repaired. They're doing some sort of refit on it. We can see that it's perched on a purpose-built cradle structure. They're adding timbers to it. They're in the middle of this refitting process. And something happened. It looks like the cradle collapsed that was supporting the ship, and the ship then falls over onto its starboard side. They tried to drain the ship, they tried to raise it, but we have enormous tidal range here, and I think the ship very quickly is going to fill with mud and water, and I think it just got, they just couldn't fight nature. They tried to refloat the ship, but every 12 hours you have hundreds of tons of water coming in, and so they eventually had to give up, and they set about salvaging what they could still reach above the mud and the water, which is why we're missing the upper parts of the ship.
How long would the ship's life have been expected to be if it hadn't suffered a mishap?
Ships very rarely died of old age. They usually met an untimely end. This is throughout history. Ships wreck all the time. They hit reefs. They catch on fire. 10 years is definitely on the short side, but the Newport ship is in absolutely remarkable condition. When they found it, the archaeologists were actually walking on it back and forth on the timbers in their steel toe caps. Even as in its waterlogged state, it was that solid. And that's really down to a couple things. They made the ship out of oak, which helps, but they tarred the ship extensively, inside, outside. Every surface, every seam, joint, overlap was filled with tar. We were pulling timbers apart, and the tar was black and gooey, and it smelled like a pine forest. And I've seen shipwrecks that are like, the timbers look like driftwood, or just look like shapeless lumps, and you're supposed to try to figure out what the ship looked like. The Newport ship is like the day it's made. We were cutting one framing timber, a big rib, in half, and it was a bit black on the outside because it was waterlogged, and it was golden yellow in the center of it, golden oak color. So the ship, it's astoundingly well preserved.
One of the things that fascinates me is that if you pull one thread, it's got like 1,000 stories connected to it, and the research is still going on all different aspects, isn't it?
Yeah, in so many ways, we've just started. We've been focused on the cleaning, recording, conservation, and we've been looking at the ship more as a whole object and figuring out, its capacity and its sailing performance and all that. But because we have such an amazingly preserved medieval ship, we can basically reverse engineer it and figure out exactly how much of this and how much of that it took to build it. And if you look at one example, like the iron nails, it took like 5 tons of wrought iron to make the 27,000 nails that were used in the ship. To make 5 tons of iron, you have to mine it, but then you have to smelt it. And you need charcoal for this. And charcoal, you need like 60 tons of charcoal to make 5 tons of wrought iron. But to make 60 tons of charcoal, you need 500 tons of wood. So you need to go in the forest, harvest 500 tons of hardwood, process it, make charcoal, and then that's the charcoal you need to mix with the ore and make the wrought iron for one set of nails for one ship. The more you pull at this, it's like concentric rings in a pond, when you throw a stone. It just keeps expanding, and we've only looked at a handful of the resources, of the many resources. We've just looked at a few, and we've just tracked them back a little bit. It may not, on the surface, seem connected, but the ship was filled. All the seams and joints of the ship were filled with tar, but to help hold the tar together, they mixed it with animal fiber. This is like cattle hair, horse hair, and waste wool. They're using vast amounts of it to kind of squish in with the tar and squish between the timbers. And when you look at it, it's actually tannery waste, the animal hair. Like, what they're doing is when they're tanning hides, they're scraping the hair off the hides, but they're actually keeping that. And must have a mountain of it, and they're selling it to the shipwrights, and the shipwrights are using it in the building of a ship. And so we can trace it back threads are going through all these different industries back to the construction of the medieval ship.
At the end of our conversation, I asked Toby if there was anything he wanted to add, and he said to tell you to come and visit. So do. There's hope that before too long the ship will be reassembled in all its glory in a spectacular new sight. But for now, there's such a charm and a wonder in seeing it here. In pieces and in process, its mysteries being slowly revealed. It was hard to summon up the courage to venture out again into the blazing sunshine. So I sat on for a while in the cool, thinking about the secrets in the mud, great ships and small birds, our lives of connection still holding on, the traces of our vast pedigrees in the neat footprints of cranes, and the stormy journeys of a barrel of wine. The steps of a child in the coming and going waters of the ancient estuary and on the banks of the Usk, and the many things the river calls on us to remember as it opens out into the sea. Keeping me company on my journeys, and I'll see you again on down the track.